Now we are beginning a study of the book of 1 Samuel. This book of 1 Samuel has to do primarily with the life of Samuel. It tells about his birth and childhood, his life and government, and right down to the time of his death in the 25th chapter. After the 25th chapter, the rest of the book of 1 Samuel and the book of 2 Samuel have to do with the reigns of Saul and David, both of whom were anointed by Samuel. It is generally thought that Samuel wrote the first portion of this book down to the 25th chapter, and the remainder of this book in 2 Samuel were written by a prophet who probably lived during the times of David. This was possibly Nathan. These two books contain the history of the last two of the judges, Eli and Samuel, who were not as the rest of the men who were judges, being men of war, but these are priests. And then these two books also contain the history of the first two kings, Saul and David, so that it ends the period of the judges and begins the period of the kings. So it's very appropriate that these two books, 1 and 2 Samuel, be placed then between the book of Judges and the books which give the history of the kings. David's Psalms, if they were placed in their proper order, would fall in the same place where these two books are found. So as we move into this book of 1 Samuel, we see that it is a story about Samuel. And it begins with an account of the family of Samuel before he is even conceived. Some of the characters in the Bible enter on the stage in the full bloom of their power, of their work, of their ministry, whatever it happens to be. But other characters, like John the Baptist and Samson, begin with their conception. And that is true of Samuel. We learn about his family, about it, the desire of his mother to have a child, and this, of course, then is the beginning of the story of Samuel. So in chapter 1, beginning with the first verse, we have an account of the state of the family into which Samuel the prophet was born. Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of Mount Ephraim. His name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zup, and Ephrathite. Now this family originally lived in Bethlehem, because we see that Zup was an Ephrathite, and that is a name for a resident of the city of Bethlehem. But somewhere along the way, they migrated up north into Ephraim. And now we see that Elkanah, the father of Samuel, lives at a place called Ramathaim Zophim. This word Zophim means watchman, and some have even thought that it means that at this city of Ramathaim, they had a school maybe for prophets. However, there is no evidence to back that up at this time. The word Ramathaim actually means Rama, and it is the city of Rama, and this city later became known as Arimathea. And we read of Joseph of Arimathea in the New Testament. Now, Joseph of Arimathea, as you remember, was a member of the Sanhedrin. He was opposed to the putting to death of our Savior that the Sanhedrin court voted in favor of. He did not voice his opposition publicly, but he was still a disciple of our Savior, and he's the one who came and begged for the body of Jesus, and then he took his body and buried it in his new tomb. So this place known as Arimathea, from which Joseph came, was the same as Ramah, which was the residence of Elkanah, the father of Samuel at this time. Verse 2, and he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now, there's a very good possibility that Hannah is, of course, the original wife. She's the one that he truly loved. But because of her barrenness, then he took Peninnah as a wife, and she was able to bear children. This is similar to the situation of Abraham and Sarah, in which Sarah was unable to have a child until she had the child of promise to come. And Hagar, of course, was able to have children, and her son Ishmael was born. Now in verse 3, we see that this family was a devout family. And this man went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. So that every year, Elkanah went to Shiloh, and there he went to sacrifice and to worship. To sacrifice would be to offer those things that God wanted in the way of offerings, and then he coupled with this also his worship the prayers and the thanksgivings to God and whatever might constitute worship to God. So he did these two things yearly at Shiloh. Now Shiloh was the place where the tabernacle was. It was the place where the Lord had the holy and the most holy place, where the Ark of the Covenant was, and where the priests centered their activities so that it truly was the abode of the Lord. And it says here, they went to sacrifice unto the Lord of Hosts in Shiloh. Now this seems to be the first time that God is called the Lord of Hosts. And it's probably because his people were in the minority, because his people seemed to have great obstacles ahead of them in the overcoming of their foes, that God specifies that he is the one that is the Lord of Hosts. That is, he is the God of those that are for him. Whoever is a godly person, although he be in the minority, although he be few in number, God is his God. He's the God of those that are his children. And so this phrase, the Lord of Hosts, reminds his people that he is their God. He's not a God that forgets about them. He's not a God that is frivolous and may turn to those that are not true followers of him. No, he's the Lord of Hosts. And wherever these hosts are, whether they be on earth or whether they be in heaven, God is their God, and he will continue to be their God as long as they look to him and do the things that are pleasing to him. So he went then to the Lord of Hosts in Shiloh yearly to worship and to sacrifice. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. Now we see that the priesthood was in a very corrupt state. Eli had allowed his sons to be the priests, and they were very corrupt people, as we're going to see. And Eli himself, who is the high priest and also the judge, has his ministry tainted by their bad behavior. And we see here that God has tied his people to one altar and one place to worship him. They cannot go someplace else to worship. They must come to Shiloh. They must come to the tabernacle, which is also called the temple here because of its permanency. And in spite of the fact, though, that there were corrupt priests here, in spite of the fact that there were things that needed to be changed and corrected and improved, still Elkanah did come yearly in worship. If they weren't going to do their part, if they were going to fall down in their duty to God, still he was going to do his part. He was going to come. He was going to worship. He was going to do as God would want him to do. And that's an example for us today. We may sometimes see those in the church that are not living the kind of life that they should live. They are actually tainted with sin. And we hope and pray that they will change, and we'll teach so that they will change, and we'll do all that we can to try to improve their lot. But it's yet not going to help things for us to say, I don't go there because they go there. We need to stay in the church. We need to stay with the church. And realizing that there are going to be some who are hypocrites. There are going to be some who are actually wrong, who pretend to be going along as though they were faithful members of the family of God. But nevertheless, it doesn't change the fact that we still have a duty to the church, an obligation to be faithful, and that's the place for us to worship. And so it is with the case of Elkanah. He went yearly to Shiloh, even though there were the sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, who were very wicked persons. Verse 4, and when the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife, and to all her sons and her daughters portions. But unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut up her womb. Now, when it came time to eat, when they ate the sacrifice that was to be eaten, he gave liberally to Peninnah and her sons and her daughters. He provided adequately for them. But when it came to Hannah, for he loved Hannah, and that's the reason we say that he probably married her originally, and she was his wife of choice, he gave her a worthy portion. That is, he gave her some of the choicest portion of the food to eat. He gave her a liberal amount of it so that she had plenty, a worthy portion. But the Lord had shut up her womb. Regardless of all the good things that Elkanah had done for Hannah, still she was a barren woman, and she labored under this stigma of not being able to have children. Verse 6, "And her adversary also provoked her sore for to make her fret, because the Lord had shut up her womb." Now, our adversary here is the other wife, Peninnah, and she is called her adversary because of the fact that she did oppose her, because she did act in a jealous, a hateful manner toward her, and she continually brought up this barrenness that Hannah had, and just wouldn't let the matter rest. So she provoked her for sore, for to make her fret. She did this on purpose. She did it to make her hurt, to make her fret, to make her unhappy. She did it to like rub salt in an old wound. She just kept on doing the things, talking about this, and making remarks in such a way as to really hurt Hannah's feelings. "And as he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat." So every year that they went up to the house of the Lord to do this, Peninnah continually provoked Hannah. She made her so unhappy that she wept and did not eat. So this particular year when they went up, Hannah just can't eat. She is so distraught. She's so upset. She's so worried, and so much cast down by this other wife, Peninnah, that she's weeping and not able to eat. She did not eat. Now we see that this idea of having two wives, which we do read about in the Old Testament, frequently brings about problems. Having two wives made trouble in Abraham's family and also in Jacob's family, and now we see that it's causing trouble in Elkanah's family. By marrying Peninnah, he no doubt was trying to solve the problem of the barrenness, but yet he created other problems that were very grievous to bear, and that is the friction that Peninnah had towards Hannah. And so many times men are beaten with the rods of their own making. So although there was this division and this unhappiness in his family, Elkanah kept up his attendance at God's altar. He kept coming back year after year to carry out this worship to God and to offer the sacrifices, and thinking maybe that if they couldn't agree on other things in the family situation, that they could at least agree upon the worship to God. And so it is with us. If we do have problems in our family, this is not an excuse to drop out of the worship and service to God. This is only a reason to get closer to God. This is only a reason to become more diligent in our service to God. And consequently then, if we're ever going to be able to work out and solve our differences, we can better do it as faithful servants of God than as those who dropped out of His service. So in verse 8 we see where Elkanah tried to console her. He tried to comfort her in her time of grief. Verse 8, "Then said Elkanah her husband to her, Hannah, why weepest thou, and why eatest thou not? Why is thy heart grieved?" Of course, he knew the reason. I'm sure he'd heard the reason many times. He knew that it was because she was barren. And so he says, "Am I not better to thee than 10 sons?" That is, he had tried to be so good to her. He had tried to so honor her and treat her in a manner that he was making up for the fact that she didn't have sons. And so in his own mind and his own reasoning, he says, "Am I not better to thee than 10 sons?" Now, of course, we know that there's no way that Elkanah could take the place of sons to Hannah. But he was acting in such a way, he was trying so hard to please her and to compensate for the fact that she was barren, until he makes this statement that "I'm better to thee than 10 sons." So he tries his best then to cheer his wife Hannah up, to make her forget about her grief, to make her more happy, more satisfied, and more content. And of course, this is the duty of one marriage partner to another. When we have a marriage partner that is suffering some kind of grief, some kind of discomfort, some kind of spiritual or physical ailment, then it's our duty to try to comfort him, try to console him, try to make up for or whatever may be lacking in their lives to make them so unhappy. And that's what Elkanah here did towards Hannah. And it seems that his attempt to comfort her did have some positive effect. For verse 9 says, "So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk." It seems like from the wording in verse 9 that she did eat and drink now. And as a result of that, she decided she's going to go and do something more about trying to solve her problem. And we're going to see what course she did take. Now Eli, the priest, sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Lord. Eli was here. He was the priest. And apparently he was sitting in some corner or kind of a secluded place where he could counsel with people. And it says that he is by a post of the temple of the Lord. Of course, we know the actual temple itself hadn't been constructed that we know of existing at Jerusalem. But because of the permanence of the tabernacle, because of its having been here for so long, it's referred to as the temple of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto the Lord and wept sore. Now, Hannah decides that she's going to turn to God. She's in bitterness of soul. Sometimes whenever we're at our very lowest depth, when we're in a state that we can truly refer to as being the bitterness of soul, that's the time then that we should turn to God. Instead of turning to other things to solve our problems, that's the time to pray the hardest. That's the time to pray the longest. That's the time to be most solemn in our attendance to the devotions of God. And so in bitterness of soul, she prayed unto the Lord. And it's real easy for us whenever we are in bitterness of soul, when we're very distraught and distressed, it's real easy for us to turn to other things and to leave God out of our lives and decide it's no use going to God, and we seek then to solve our own problems in ungodly ways or in ways that we don't have the assistance of God in, and consequently we just make our misery worse. But not so with Hannah. She prayed to God. Now she no doubt remembered that her husband Elkanah said that I am better to thee than 10 sons, of which we know that he wasn't better than 10 sons. He couldn't be. But she could turn to God, and God could be better to her than 10 sons. And she realized this. And so that's what she did here in bitterness of soul. She prayed unto the Lord. Now this was a prayer that was a wet prayer. She wept sore. She had red eyes as a result of this prayer and as a result of her condition. And as she wept, she prayed to the Lord. And sometimes our most sincere, our most earnest prayers are given in a state of weeping, in a state of sadness, in a state of dejection. But here she turns to her one and only true source of help. She turns to God and she prays to Him. So we must remember that whatever our problem, whatever our circumstances, prayer not only always is in order, but it is always necessary. We must pray to God. We must turn to God. There is no problem too great but what prayer is indicated. And there is also no problem too small but what prayer is indicated. In connection with this prayer, Hannah also makes a vow. Verse 11. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. So she makes a vow here, and in connection with the vow, she further gives the particulars of what her requests are. She wants the Lord to remember her. If you will just remember me and not forget thine handmaid. And we must always bear in mind that God does remember us. He knows about us. He hasn't forgotten us. It's simply a matter of our getting in harmony with His will, with His divine purpose. And then He brings about His will and His desire in us. And that's what Hannah is doing here. She's getting close to God. She's praying to God and begging Him to remember her, not to forget her. And of course, if we put ourselves into a position where God is forced to forget us, where God is forced to give us up to our ways, forced to turn His back on us, because of our sin, then of course we are one that will be forgotten by God. And that's a very sad and tragic state to be in. That's one we want to all avoid being in. And that's what Hannah is praying here, to be delivered of, a state in which she might possibly have been forgotten by God. But the particular request she makes here, if thou will give unto thine handmaid a man child. Now she didn't ask for an abundance of children. She didn't ask even for plural children. One child. Give me a man child. Then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life. So she vows that this child will be dedicated to God, dedicated to the service of God, and that's all the days of his life, from his birth until his death. And she further says, and there shall no razor come upon his head, so that she seems to be taking a Nazarite vow for this child. So he will be specially consecrated to God. He's going to be a gift of God. She's fully persuaded that if she has a child, it'll be because God allows her to have a God, because it is a present of God. It's a special dispensation of mercy that God gives to her for her to be able to have this child. So she in turn then is going to dedicate this child to God. No razor should come upon his head. Now it seems to be proper and appropriate for us to take certain blessings which we fully feel that we received a special providence of from God, and to dedicate or to devote them to the use of the service of God. Here's an example of this. And so there may be things in our lives in which we feel a very special blessing in. We feel like that we have been blessed above the average run-of-the-mill person in receiving this blessing. And so we feel so strongly about this, and we're so thankful for it, until we want to dedicate it or a portion of it to the work of God. It may be our time, it may be our talent, it may be our money, it may be some special possession that we have. But nevertheless, it would be an appropriate thing to do here if we feel as Hannah did, that without God specially blessing us in this, we just wouldn't have it at all. And so she dedicates this child unto the Lord all the days of his life. We're going to close at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.